You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, healthy eating can be a much bigger deal than just making sure you eat your servings of fruit and veggies. Our next guest tells us how typical nutrition standards often leave people of color and non-European cultures feeling like their food staples aren't good enough. First, between now and the August 14th primary, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested primaries for statewide office and congressional seats to join us for interviews here on Central Time and on The Morning Show. You'll be able to find all of these interviews at wisconsinvote.org. Today we talk to Kevin Adam Steen. He goes by Adam, but he appears as his full name on the ballot. He's a farmer and an engineer, and he's a Republican running for a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives in Wisconsin's first congressional district, which includes Janesville. Adam, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, let's start. Just take half a minute or so to pitch yourself to voters in the first district. What would you say about why you're running?
Why am I running for this race? Well, I've got a daughter that's four, one on the way in December, and I believe that our country was founded on morals and values, and our Constitution was written to govern a moral people. And I really feel like we've lost some of that base concerns that we used to have and care about, and I really felt like no one in this race was willing to support the values that I held dear, and I thought being a father, an engineer working in this district, living in Kenosha, I would be able to represent the broadest spectrum of people possible in this district, and there was a need. There was no one running that was from Wisconsin at the time, and I thought I have the ability, I have the desire and the willingness to step forward and serve, and I thought that's a necessary part of our country, that a citizen legislature should step forward and serve.
Can you tell us about a couple issues where you feel like you would meet the needs of constituents better than the other Republicans in this primary?
Oh, very, very easily, sir. So I feel like the top three issues that are facing this district are spending, immigration, and tariffs. Those three issues, we talk about the tax cuts. The tax cuts are a wonderful thing, but you're not going to be able to continue those tax cuts if our government continues to spend as it is right now. So if we can decrease our spending in a federal level, we can keep those tax cuts real to these people here in the first district. The immigration issue is huge. I've been serving on the Wisconsin Soybean Board, working with national and federal officials, trying to bring a market to our soybeans, understanding the tariff issue we're going through so that we can actually bring a quality product to market and be able to market it effectively. So that immigration issue is huge because we need labor to harvest these products, not just our milk industry here in Wisconsin, but the produce industry that we have. So huge, huge issues. And then finally, the tariffs come back together to tie it all together. Our president is doing what I believe is correct for our country. There is some short-term effects that we're seeing right now that are putting a strain on our economy, but I believe that we can open up these trade agreements again so that the U.S. can be a strong position in our world economy.
Let's key in on immigration for a moment. What kind of solutions would you like to see to have that legal supply of labor you're talking about, and also talk a little bit about illegal immigration, if you would?
Wonderful, sir. So very, very quickly, it's a simple process. We have a concept in our country called legal immigration. My great-grandfather and mother came to this country legally, and they became citizens. So we need to enforce that program. But right now we have a problem with our employers. We need to implement and use this program called Fast Track. We need to fast track our immigrants to this country that are even here right now. We need to fast track their citizenship so that they can become citizens because we have employers that need labor and they are here working. So we need to fill that void with our Fast Track program. But we also have to look at the other side, and a lot of people negate the fact that there are people here that are not productive members of our society, and there is a place for them, but it is back in their home country. It is not here. So our country is based on laws. Robert Frost said good fences make good neighbors, and I think that's a critical component of the founding of our country is you have to have those borders defined, and you have to have a process in place that actually encourages people to want to come to this country and want to do it legally. So that's the quick version.
And you're running to replace, ultimately, House Speaker Paul Ryan. How do you evaluate his almost 20 years representing the 1st District?
Oh, goodness. I can do it very quickly. I can give him. Let's go through a report card for Paul Ryan. He was an excellent representative for our district. He never made our Republican Party look bad. Go down to letter B. He was a solid vote, a solid Republican vote for this district. Even in a swing district, he was elected 10 times. So he's done very well. But as a speaker, I give him a C because, as respectfully as I can, he's an average speaker with 20 years of experience. He should have been able to return much more for the first district. And then D, when it comes to a local representative, we're here in Kenosha County. When it came to the casino or GM in Kenosha, Chrysler in Kenosha or GM in Janesville, he just never had a voice for this district locally. So I believe he did a good job as a representative, but I probably should zip down to letter Z and zip it and let him go on and enjoy his retirement. But I think as a whole, he was a positive influence on this district.
Talking to Adam Steen. He's a farmer, engineer, and he's a Republican running for a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives in Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District. I just want to talk about your name for a moment so people aren't confused on the ballot. I'm calling you Adam Steen. You'll appear on the ballot as Kevin, quote, Adam, end quote, Steen, if I have that right.
That is correct, sir. My parents named me Kevin Adam Steen, and my father has been Kevin my whole life, so I've gone by Adam. I appreciate it.
I want to get into some more issues. On your campaign website, you talk about abortion as an important issue. Can you talk a little bit about your views and what you would try to do in Congress?
Sure. Well, here's something that we don't see in our political system anymore. We don't see people willing to let this district or let their constituents know who they are. So I grew up in a Christian home. I believe that through my upbringing that marriage is defined between a man and a woman and abortion is wrong, that life begins at conception. But many people like to say, well, does that mean you can't represent someone that believes otherwise? I said, no, not in the least. I spent 4 years at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and that some people claim that that's 60 square miles surrounded by reality, but I wouldn't go that far. Madison is an extremely open town, and we had discussions left and right. When you don't agree with someone, that's not a bad thing. That's how this country was founded. When you had disagreements, you're able to come to a consensus. So I have those values and beliefs, and that defines who I am. But I think when you talk about representing a district with 750,000 people, you will not always agree. But I think it's important to be able to have those discussions and know who you're voting for and what they believe.
Washington is pretty polarized. That's no secret. Do you see yourself? I mean, you are someone who's running as a conservative Republican.
Yep.
Do you see room for cooperation with the Democrats, whether you were in a majority or a minority in the House?
Oh, I do I really do, because I have a view that, to me, sets me apart from many other people in this race, where if you're willing to see that there's a problem, no matter what it is, if you want to talk about our immigration system, health care, education, guns, if you're willing to address the fact that there is a problem and have a discussion about the solution, that's what I think we're missing. So I honestly feel that people will be drawn to me because I have the ability to recognize problems and have an open discussion about those problems with, I guess to me the key is having the people you're representing in mind, not myself. So my goal, I got an engineering degree from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I have no intention of changing my career. I would love to return as an engineer, but I think it's important that the background that we bring to this thing we call politics, the backgrounds that we bring are important because we're able to represent people. And having a job and currently working through this election process is important to me because I can do that. I can represent those people that are working and understand what families are going through or trying to buy a house. So all kinds of fun stuff.
I want to get into another issue or two.
Sure.
Let's talk about health care a little bit. A lot of argument over the last bunch of years about the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. Mm-hmm. What would you do in Congress on that issue?
Well, in Congress, I would step in as a junior congressman, so one of 435 voting members of Congress in the 116th Congress that we'd be setting in session. And to me, our healthcare system, we have providers, And we have a system that I believe is broken. And those providers are separated from the men and women that are using that system. They're separated by this insurance gap. So to me, I would like to start a plan that would remove the federal government's hands from our healthcare system. So Obamacare is not a necessity. But I believe that we could remove Obamacare over time. I'm not a... What's the right word? I'm a realist. I know that our federal government is so entrenched in these programs that if you instantly remove them, you would have a failure of the entities that exist in our healthcare system. So we would remove the federal government slowly within a 5 to 10 year time period, and also if we could pull out this insurance gap. So each individual, I go to the doctor. Let's say my bill is $1,000, and then the insurance gets done with it, and it's $200. So I don't even know what my health care costs are. And there's so much of a disconnect between the individual paying and the actual billing department. So I would like to see a more direct system where I can interact with my health care provider directly instead of going through a third party. And that would, to me, that would lower cost, and that would enable people to understand what their real costs are.
That's all the time we have. Adam Steen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No, I appreciate it. Have a great day. Thanks, Rob.
Kevin, Adam Steen is a farmer and an engineer. He's running as a Republican for a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives in Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District, which includes Janesville. Brian Steele, a Republican candidate in that race, joins us this time tomorrow. Between now and the August 14th primary, candidates running in contested primaries are joining us for interviews on Central Time in the Morning Show. You can follow them all at wisconsinvote.org. First, when you think about health food, what comes to mind? Maybe it's the leafy greens, fresh veggies, and whole grains. It can be easy for a white American middle-class household to find healthy recipes that fit in with their food traditions, but it can be different for people who grew up in homes with different food traditions. Our next guest says there are healthy eating options in lots of different cultures, and dietitians and others need to pay attention. Tamara Melton is a registered dietitian and co-founder of Diversify Dietetics, a nonprofit organization dedicated to increasing racial and ethnic diversity in the nutrition and dietetics profession. She joins us to talk about her piece in Self magazine called Our Idea of Healthy Eating Excludes Other Cultures, and That's a Problem. Tamara, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on today.
Well, talk about how you started to discover this problem and see it as a problem.
So I actually discovered it while I was in school to become a dietitian. My father is from Trinidad, so in my household we grew up eating Trinidadian food, and I was sitting there. I remember being in one class, and we're learning about foods and cultures, and I'm just not seeing beyond this kind of anthropological view any representation of foods outside of this Eurocentric lens and the norm. And so I started to notice it then, but then I saw it even further as I graduated and I sat for the exam, became a registered dietitian, and I started working with patients and clients. And so I started to have this idea that, you know, I'm not seeing anything outside of this mainstream, white American view of healthy foods, but that doesn't necessarily mean that these other types of foods aren't healthy. It's just that they weren't being presented not only in the media, but even the textbooks for those of us who are, you know, definitely the nutrition experts, the registered dietitian is, but we weren't even being taught the different views of different cultures and how their foods could also be considered healthy.
And you and your colleagues at Diversify Dietetics, I understand you came across examples where people came here, were maybe immigrants to the United States or part of a minority culture, and had the idea that, okay, if I want to do healthy eating, I have to just cast all my food traditions aside.
Right. So, I think that people forget that representation matters, but sometimes not seeing something means something to people too. So I would be working with clients or patients, and they would say to me, you know, I know the way that I ate back home, I shouldn't be eating that way because it's not healthy. Or I know that the way I'm feeding my children isn't healthy. And it was almost as if, and I wrote this in the piece, as if we were asking them to choose their health over their heritage. They couldn't have both and the same. And so that was something that just really struck me as I got further along in my career and worked with more patients and clients. They just really wanted to be able to fulfill themselves with not only being healthy, but being able to keep that connection. Food is such a big connection to your history, to your heritage, especially if you immigrated to a different country. Even in within the United States here, in our own country, you go to different parts of the United States and people like to eat. There are certain types of food that they have. And so that even reminds them of home. So those patients and clients were kind of sitting there, and I realized that the reason why they were thinking that was because they didn't see the types of food that they were eating back home represented as an idea of a healthy meal. And so that to them meant this must not be healthy.
And I think in American culture, a lot of times we think of an ethnic food as the foods that appear in restaurants, which may not be representative and maybe the least healthy, the stuff with the highest fat content, the most fried meals, things like that, whether we're talking about Chinese food or Mexican food or even soul food from parts of the U.S.
Exactly, yes. We see this Americanized version of foods, and it takes out the context. So I mentioned in the article, you know, that when people would say to me, all sorts of, you know, clients from all different ethnic backgrounds would say, oh, I ate bad this week and I had Mexican food. And what they were talking about was having queso and chips and margaritas. But that's not representative of Mexican food. That's not all of their food that's there. And so I think that we have to realize that our version of foods here, especially if it's in a mainstream restaurant, you're not getting it from, you know, that local hole in the wall that might be in the community that is actually comprised of people from that area of the world, may not be representative. And even as you brought up, you know, a soul food, I live in Atlanta, so I live in the Deep South. And when you know the history of why black people in the United States are eating this soul food, it goes back to slavery and things like that. So there's so many more things that goes into foods. Not only could it be history, like I mentioned, and maybe different social or political things that happen that are affecting the way people eat, but a lot of celebrations and things like that. That's why people are eating the way that they are. But often what we see represented is not what, if you were to go into a restaurant that is run by someone from that area of the world or region, then their food doesn't look the same as what we think that their food looks like because of what we've been presented with.
So if you're talking to a client from whatever tradition, how does this work for you in practice? How do you help integrate, you know, their food traditions, their cultural heritage with healthy eating?
So I try to spend a lot of time exploring what they eat and asking them, you know, what are the foods that you like to eat? How do you prepare them? And then really helping them to see that what they're eating, you know, there's always healthy foods in everything that we eat. And most cultures are really, a lot of them are plant-based. It's more difficult to get animal proteins, whether that be in meat form or for thinking of dairy or something like that that's derived from animal products. And so they're actually eating quite a bit of fruits and vegetables and beans, legumes, whole grains, things that we would want to see people eating, and smaller amounts of meat, which we know from research is actually pretty healthy. And so when I work with people, I'll tell them, you know, the way that you're eating is really healthy. And pointing out to them that maybe there's, especially if they gain weight from moving to the United States, you know, looking at your physical activity level, did that change? And not necessarily making them think that it tied back to the fact that they changed the way that they're eating. But I also, for myself, educate myself more. And I think that's important for health professionals. Whatever community that you serve, you know who your patients and your clients are. To go out there and go to, in the community, not to the Americanized version in a gentrified neighborhood of a restaurant, but actually go to the markets within their communities, go to, like I said, that hole-in-the-wall restaurant, and actually see how food's prepared, talk to people who live in those neighborhoods, and educate yourself so that when you do come in front of your client or your patient, it just really warms their heart when you tell them, yes, I know, you know, how your empanadas are prepared in Colombia versus in Mexico. I'm not lumping everyone together. Things like that, it just really puts them at ease, and you just have so much more information. That is our job as nutrition professionals on behalf of our clients and patients to make sure that we go out there and do that. So I really try to do that as much as possible just to learn about different cultures and talk to people and learn the way that they prepare their food so that I can help them with whatever their health goals are.
And it seems like this is something that could help everybody, regardless of the tradition they're from, because it wasn't that long ago that I think people thought health food meant a glob of lentils with raw kale sprinkled on top and not much flavor. Exposing people to healthy food traditions from around the world can make healthy food a lot more fun and tasty.
Yeah, it adds so much variety. I think that is one thing that's exciting about having more global cuisines in the United States and in other, you know, parts of the world, too. Throughout Europe, we've seen this, and in other parts of different continents and things like that, is that it adds so much more variety. When you get access to, you know, things like more spices, cooking methods, you can probably sit there, if you've ever tried meal planning, it just expands what you're eating. You're not eating the same old chicken and broccoli and brown rice. That gets boring after a while, but, you know, can you take those same components and turn it into a curry? Or can you turn it into a stew? Or can you turn it into a braised meat or something like that? And you're putting in these global flavors. When you actually start to expose that, that actually is helpful for everyone. It adds in more variety. We as humans want variety in the way that we eat. And there's so many ways to eat healthfully if you look outside your own culture. Every culture has a way of using either meal preparation methods or spices, or even the way that they store their food that makes it taste so much better. It's actually easier to eat more healthfully if you have a more wide variety of the types of food that you've tasted and the types of food that you eat.
It's a good place to leave it. Tamara, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tamara Melton is a registered dietitian and co-founder of Diversify Dietetics, a nonprofit organization dedicated to increasing racial and ethnic diversity in the nutrition and dietetics profession. She joined us to talk about how mainstream ideas of health food often leave out foods from different cultures. Now, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested primaries for statewide office and congressional seats to join us for interviews on Central Time and The Morning Show. You can find all of those interviews at wisconsinvote.org. Today, we continue our interviews with candidates for governor. There's a contested primary for both Republicans and Democrats. Today, we talk to Kelda Royce. She's a small business owner, former state representative, and attorney. She's running in the Democratic primary. Kelda Royce, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be with you, Rob.
We'll start off with your elevator pitch. What would you tell someone in the length of an elevator ride about why you're running for governor?
I'm running for governor because I want Wisconsin to be a place of opportunity and fairness again. I think our state can be the best place to raise a family and the best place to grow a business. And we need a governor who's more focused on solving our common challenges than dividing people.
And how do you see your experience in business as a former state representative as a good background for someone running for governor?
Well, certainly I have executive experience, and prior to my service in the legislature, I ran a statewide organization focused on women's health advocacy, NARO Pro-Choice Wisconsin. But I've got the track record of actually turning our progressive ideas into real results for Wisconsin families. As a state legislator, I helped expand access to health care, affordable coverage to over 80,000 Wisconsinites. I worked on issues like early childhood education, health and safety for kids, protecting our environment. And that's the kind of experience, actually passing legislation and getting things done, that we need in our next governor.
Looking at the job situation in Wisconsin, Governor Walker can point toward very low unemployment rates here in the state. Why would Wisconsinites want to change from him to you or any of your Democratic colleagues?
Well, if you actually talk to the people around this state, as I have over the past several months, you realize that a lot of folks may be working 2, 3, 4 jobs and yet still unable to make ends meet. You know, the majority of the new jobs that are coming online into our economy are not good family-supporting jobs that have benefits, but they're low-wage jobs that don't actually pay enough to allow people to live. So we need to do much more to increase access to good jobs, jobs that you can use to sustain yourself. And that's why, as a small business owner, I'm so passionate about making Wisconsin a place where people can earn good wages and people can start and grow small businesses.
At a policy level, how do you try to do that, boost wages and boost small business growth?
Well, we can certainly raise the minimum wage. That's an important thing that many other states have done, and that helps our economy by putting more money in the pockets of workers, especially the lowest paid workers. But we also need to stop doing these corporate welfare deals, whether it's Foxconn or the way that the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation has been used as a slush fund. Instead, we need to make it easier for small business owners, and I'm talking about anybody from a family farmer to somebody opening a cafe on Main Street to somebody with an innovative idea for a tech company, to be able to get capital to start that business or expand, hire people, and get technical assistance so that first-time entrepreneurs, especially people who might not have been able to get a traditional bank loan or don't have mentors out there who can help them, can actually pursue their dream.
You mentioned the Foxconn incentive package. If elected as governor, what would your approach be to Foxconn?
Well, I think we need to be as responsible and strategic in getting ourselves out of that terrible deal and mitigating its worst effects as we were irresponsible and Walker was selfish in getting into the Foxconn deal. I think part of the strategy is certainly using the Great Lakes Compact to protect our Great Lakes water. We need to oppose the air pollution that is going to be coming out of the Foxconn deal, as well as the eminent domain abuses. I actually had the opportunity to go and meet with Kim and Jim Mahoney and see the home that they spent 9 years saving for and building. And after living there less than a year, they were told they were going to have to make way for Foxconn. So we need to have a governor who understands the not just the economic cost to taxpayers, but also the human cost, and is willing to fight for protections that address the needs of taxpayers as well as homeowners and our environment.
Talking to Calder Royce about her campaign for governor in the Democratic primary. Before you face Governor Walker, you've got seven other people running as Democrats in this primary. How do you distinguish yourself from this crowded field?
Well, it's a great question. We've got seven great people running, but I am the strongest candidate to beat Scott Walker, and really that's what this is about. If we want to take Wisconsin in a new direction, we need to have someone who can win. We have built a strong strategic campaign with great grassroots volunteers and donors all over the state. We've excited the Democratic base voters that we need to win, and we're reaching the younger voters, Gen Xers, millennials, folks in their 40s and 30s and 20s who don't vote as frequently as baby boomers, but they are going to show up for our campaign, and that's how we're going to win in November. We also need someone who is running a smart and strategic campaign, and there's a reason why national leaders like Emily's List, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, and the nation's perhaps foremost public education advocate, Diane Ravitch, are all backing my campaign, because they understand that I'm the strongest candidate to beat Walker, and they know what's at stake.
And speaking of education, what would your priorities be when it comes to schools in Wisconsin?
Well, we got to make sure that our public dollars are funding public education, not continuing to subsidize private schools. We also need to make sure that we're restoring the funding that's been cut under Governor Walker, and that the funding is equitably distributed. Right now, we've got a funding formula that really deprives our urban and rural schools of the resources they need, because it's based on an archaic formula using property taxes, and that needs to change. Because wherever I am in Wisconsin, whether it's the north side of Milwaukee or the North Woods, people understand that we are not making the investments we need to in our public schools.
And how about the voucher program in Wisconsin?
Well, I think we have had a failed 27-year experiment with a voucher program. We now know that voucher schools perform no better, and in a lot of cases, they actually perform worse than our public schools. And we really can't afford to be experimenting on kids anymore. So we need to bring that program to a responsible end. We're not going to displace any of the kids who are currently in their voucher schools in Milwaukee and Racine. Those are longstanding programs. But we are going to give those schools an option to become public charter schools that are overseen and accountable to a local elected school board. And we're going to not allow any new voucher students to be going into these schools, because we just can't keep underfunding two separate school systems.
One big point of contention in state budgets every couple of years comes to road funding, transportation and infrastructure spending, and how to pay for road maintenance and construction in Wisconsin. Would you be open to promoting things like increased user fees, increases in the gas tax, or toll roads?
Yeah, we need an adult in the driver's seat here. And I actually have a comprehensive plan for this and all the other issues we've discussed on my website, which is keldaforgovernor.com, if listeners want to learn more about the details. But we need a long-term transportation and infrastructure plan. I do think we need a modest adjustment in the gas tax, including reindexing it to inflation. I also think we should look at high-capacity fees on these commercial vehicles, like the trucks that carry mined frac sand up and down our roadways, because they're really the ones that are destroying the roads at a much faster rate than just ordinary passenger vehicles. But we also need to look at infrastructure like transit, public transit, including a high-speed rail link between Chicago and the Twin Cities that should run through Wisconsin. We also need to look at broadband connectivity throughout the state. So there's a lot of investments that we need to be making, and if we're going to do that, we have to stop making irresponsible fiscal decisions like putting basic road maintenance on the credit card.
We're talking to Kelder Royce about her campaign for governor in the Democratic primary, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What question do you have for the candidate? Do you want to hear her take on a particular issue? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Kelder Royce is with us. We're talking about her campaign in the Democratic primary for governor of Wisconsin. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What question do you have for Kelder Royce? What issue do you want to hear her weigh in on? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. To your calls now, Sherry is on the line in Mequon. Sherry, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to ask about?
I want to ask what her take on legalizing marijuana is, and if she is for it, what are the steps that she's going to take to make sure it's legal?
Sherry, thanks for the call. Kelder Royce?
Yes, I do think the time has come to legalize cannabis, both for medicinal purposes and also for adult recreational use. I think we can look at what's happened in other states and see that they've had an influx of tax revenue, which is great and important, and a decrease in opioid overdose deaths, which is also very important. And given the fact that Wisconsin really desperately needs criminal justice reform and we have some of the worst racial disparities in the nation, legalizing cannabis is a good first step to addressing that issue.
Sherry, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Owen in Wauwega. Owen, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call, Rob. Kelda, I just wanted to tell you, I think you got a lot of great ideas, and I hope that this can go somewhere for you. One of the questions I have is this. I'm a young beginning dairy farmer in the state of Wisconsin, and as you well know, we're facing a lot of economic disparity right now at this time. I'm continuing to watch the larger corporate farms around me continue to expand in an already oversupplied milk market where the milk values are diminishing based on oversupply. As a result of this, they're continuing to hire labor who are not eligible voters. What are we going to do to help these people who are working for these farmers become voters and participate in democracy and also have the ability to work in other businesses and other occupations or continue to farm on their own at their own farms as voters? What are we going to do to restore democracy to the people and bring back a constitutional rights for people who actually are farming land and feeding this nation?
Owen, thanks for the call. So a lot there, Kelder Royce, helping small
yes.
farmers and concern about immigrant workers on larger farms.
Yes. Well, I've heard from farmers all over the state, including, you know, up northern Wisconsin, where I spent my time as a little girl, to right here in Dane County, where I represented farmers and ag in the legislature, that we have made it so easy for large corporate farms to pollute our water and air, and that just exacerbates the financial struggles for our smaller family farmers, which is a much more sustainable farming model. So if we want to preserve our rural heritage, our tradition as the dairy state with family farmers, we have got to make it more economically feasible for smaller family farmers to compete. You know, on the second issue of immigration, you're right. We need to treat the human beings who are coming here to work with dignity and respect. And I have never hesitated to stand up to the racism of Donald Trump's administration and the bigotry. I also called out Scott Walker for going along with Trump's request for National Guard troops from Wisconsin to go help abet his immoral family separation policy at the border. So as governor, I certainly support making sure that our undocumented workers have access to driver's cards so that they can do driver's ed and be insured and be safe on the roadway as we all deserve to be. I also support making sure that we protect our dreamers and offer them in-state tuition at our universities. And, you know, ultimately we need to make sure that people in our state, whatever their documentation status is, are treated with respect. We need comprehensive immigration reform that recognizes the realities of our economy and, you know, protects our small business owners and entrepreneurs from predatory practices by big business.
Owen, thanks for that call. We're talking to Calda Royes about her campaign for governor. She's in the Democratic primary. You can join in with your question for her at 800-642-1234. We go now to Ann in Madison. Ann, hi.
I read for free technology.
Oops, Ann, your line is breaking up, but it sounds like she's asking about your plan for free technical college education. Calda Royes, can you talk about that?
Yes, I think this is really important. And this is one area where I disagree with my friend Tony Evers, because I think that we need to have the doors of higher education open to everyone. And using a last dollar tuition credit program really makes this affordable for state taxpayers. And if you look at other states that have done this, they have seen the number of first-generation college students and students of color skyrocketing, because when younger people think it's too expensive, I won't be able to afford it, they don't even apply to college. And we need to make sure that they know that it's an option for them. And so for that reason, I think it's really important that we not only make two-year technical colleges free for students so that they apply, but we also need to address the student loan debt crisis that affects nearly 900,000 Wisconsinites who have already gone to college.
Thanks for that call, Ann. We'll go to Scott now in Chippewa Falls. Scott, hello.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. My question is, I'm a small business owner, and I am not excited about the Foxconn deal because it's, I'm sure it'll create jobs in southern Wisconsin, but I'm in northern, you know, the northern part of the state, and I'm wondering, you know, when a big deal like this goes through, the cash flow that flows to some one percenter, so I'm getting hit twice. I'm being taxed to pay for this big project to go in that's going to, you know, make an economy good for a few people in the southern part of the state and hurt all the rest of us, and then the money will go to some one percenters. Is there any way to find out where that money is heading?
Calda Royes?
Well, that's a very important question. That is one reason why we need to make sure we have a governor who's going to take a multi-pronged approach to the Foxconn deal. And as a small business owner myself, I know exactly how you're feeling. It's like a slap in the face because we're going to be paying to line the pockets of a, you know, foreign corporation worth billions and billions of dollars. And, you know, we're here investing in our communities, growing businesses, employing people, and you know, not getting much love. So we do need to have real accountability and know where the funds are going. That's one of the major problems with this deal. But just imagine, you know, if you think about Wisconsin, we're a big state. We have 72 counties. If you took $3 billion, the cost of the incentive package that we're giving to Foxconn, and you said, we're going to take that and instead of just giving it all to one corporation in one part of the state, instead we're going to give it to 30,000 businesses. We're going to give them $100,000 each, and we're going to make sure that it's evenly distributed around the state. That would mean, on average, each county would have over 400 new businesses with $100,000 in capital. Now, I'm not necessarily suggesting that we do it exactly like that, but it just gives you a sense of what the possibilities are. You know, we could also be investing that money in education. We could also be investing that money in broadband connectivity and transit and roads. There are a lot of good things that we could spend that money on that would have a much greater economic impact on every part of the state, and it would actually benefit folks like you who are running a small business and paying your taxes.
Scott, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Max is on the line now in Manitowoc. Max, hi.
Hey, this is going to be a smaller issue, but I feel it's really important to me and my generation. I'm a millennial. And as you are aware of, the FCC had repealed the net neutrality laws. And as far as I know, our governor currently has been kind of mum about the situation. So if you're elected as our governor, would you follow suit, as other states have, to enforce that net neutrality at the state level? That's my question.
Yes, I definitely would. I definitely would, Max. And this is something I've been concerned about for many years. The internet is, in many ways, a utility that's just as essential to modern life as electrification was in the last century. So we need a governor who understands that and understands the economic impact of people being able to access the content that they want, not only to be connected to high-speed internet, but then to be able to make sure that their internet service provider isn't slowing down certain disfavored content and you know, almost functioning as a sensor by making some content load more quickly or more slowly. So that is definitely an important issue. And I think it's great that that you called, Max, because baby boomers in our state vote very consistently. But unfortunately, Democrats don't win if we don't get the votes of younger folks showing up, of Generation X folks like me and millennials like you, Max. The way we win elections is by having a candidate that people get excited about and are ready to go to the polls and vote for someone, rather than just having a candidate that younger voters feel is ho-hum or doesn't really speak to issues that are important, like paid family leave or affordable child care or student loan debt or climate change or any of the concerns that I hear a lot from younger voters. So thanks for calling.
Thanks for the call, Max. Briefly, as we wrap up, one possible outcome is a Democratic governor and a Republican legislature. If you were a Democratic governor in that situation, could you work with Republicans to get stuff done?
Absolutely. And I think this is one thing that really sets me apart. I have a long history of getting things done, working not just with Democrats, but in reaching across the aisle. When I was the head of NARAL Pro-Choice Wisconsin, I helped pass the first pro-choice law in a generation in the state, even though the assembly was at that time controlled by an anti-choice Republican majority. I know how to reach across the aisle and get things done. And, of course, I'll certainly be working to elect Democrats to the legislature and make sure that we have fair maps that are not gerrymandered so voters can choose their elected officials. But I'm very confident that I'll be able to make positive change for Wisconsin families, regardless of who's in control in the legislature.
Calderoys, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
Calderoys is running for governor as a Democrat. Madison Mayor Paul Soglin, who's also running for governor as a Democrat, joins us at this time tomorrow. Profiles of all the Democratic and Republican candidates for governor can be found at WPR.org/governor. We'll still be doing more of these candidate interviews in races for governor and Congress this week on the Ideas Network.